You are listening to Mind Over Matters here on KEXP 90.3 FM Seattle. It is 7:30 and time once again for Community Forum, and we are very lucky to have with us this morning Sanho Tree, who is director of the Drug Policy Project at the Institute for Policy Studies in Washington, D.C., and he is in town talking about Plan Columbia. Sanho, it is great to have you this morning.
Thanks, Mike. Great to be here.
Let me start out and ask you to tell us, what is the Drug Policy Project?
It's a program at the Institute for Policy Studies in Washington, D.C. that focuses on the intersection of race and poverty in the war on drugs and trying to find alternatives to the current paradigm, which is a zero-tolerance, you know, crackdown approach, and trying to find policies that really do look after public health and public safety rather than social control, which is what, you know, the current policies are about.
All right, and you're in town talking to several different groups, I believe specifically about Plan Columbia, is that correct?
Right. The Seattle Columbia Committee is the group that invited us out here, and they're doing great work in building an impressive coalition of human rights groups, drug policy groups, environmental groups, and other folks concerned with solidarity issues.
All right, and if you would talk about the U.S. drug policy seems to be focused on eradication and interdiction in Latin America. Talk, if you would, about the realities of that particular policy.
Well, what that translates into on the ground is, last year Congress approved a $1.3 billion militarized aid package for Colombia and a little bit for its neighbors. But basically, 80% of that goes to the Colombian security forces. And the thrust of this Plan Colombia, or the U.S. part of it anyway, is about pacifying southern Colombia, where the guerrillas have been strong. So many of us believe this is more about counterinsurgency than counter-narcotics. And when they pacify this region, quote-unquote, then the fumigation planes come in. So we send in crop dusters that dump tremendous amounts of this broad-spectrum herbicide called glyphosate. You can find a form of it in a hardware store called Roundup. And what we're using is Roundup Ultra. It's even stronger, and we're mixing it with other chemicals to make it more potent. And we're dumping this stuff all over the Amazon, trying to eradicate coca crops, which is just sheer folly because there's just so much land area available in the Amazon basin to grow these things. Coca is not just an Andean phenomenon. It just doesn't just grow on the mountainsides of Bolivia and Peru. It'll grow on the jungle floors, the rainforest. It'll grow in any climate that doesn't freeze. So that, you know, Indonesia, prior to World War II, was a major exporter of cocaine. So this is a crop, you know, this is a weed, basically, that will grow anywhere. It's a bush. But, you know, when we're talking about marijuana or poppy, where we get heroin from, these things will grow in all 50 states. And we're trying to chase this around. And that's the best we've ever been able to do is push this crop around from one place to the next, from one country to the next, from one continent to the next. And, you know, even the conservative RAND Corporation did a study commissioned by the U.S. Army and by the Drug Czar's office a couple of years ago. And, you know, they found that this was an incredibly ineffective policy, that if you were really concerned about reducing cocaine use in the United States, they found that when they crunched all the numbers, dollar for dollar, it was 23 times more effective to fund treatment for addicts in the United States than it was to eradicate drugs at the source, as in Colombia. So we are actually following the most wasteful, the least productive means of reducing drug use, if that is indeed what Congress is concerned about.
Talk, if you would, about some of the effects that dumping these tons of herbicides on Colombia and Latin America have.
Well, it's an environmental catastrophe. And more we're seeing environmental groups get, you know, really furious about this. Indeed, the bird people, the bird watchers, are up in arms about this. Colombia is one of the most biodiverse countries, I think the second most biodiverse country in the world. 10 to 15% of all terrestrial plant and animal species can be found in Colombia. I mean, it's just an absolutely amazing Garden of Eden. And what we're doing is dumping this herbicide and wiping out vast stretches of the Amazon. It kills anything green. This stuff is being sprayed by airplane, even though our State Department assures us that they're doing this with on a precision basis, right? They swore up and down at the U.S. Embassy when I was down there in Bogota. They said, "Oh no, we use GPS guided spray planes, 3 feet of accuracy." And of course, you know, Senator Wellstone, who's been a great critic of this war, went down last December, and the State Department set up a nice demonstration fumigation run for him to observe. And sure enough, the plane came down nice and low and hit Senator Wellstone and his staff with this glyphosate. He was not amused.
Imagine. So get back to, if you would, then, the obviously the way we're approaching this is the wrong way. What would be the correct method for our drug policy if you were in charge of it?
Right. It's not just about drug policy. It's about looking at a lot of the root causes of what's behind this drug economy and why people choose to self-medicate to such high levels. First of all, you know, I subscribe to a philosophy called harm reduction. That means acknowledging that mind-altering drugs have been with us since before recorded history and always will be with us at some level or another. We'll never completely eradicate this problem. And so our policy should be about reducing the harm that's caused by some of these potentially very dangerous drugs, as well as reducing the harm caused by the war on drugs, which, in my opinion, the war on drugs is now causing more harm than the drugs themselves. And that is the basis for a bankrupt policy. So we need to focus on alternatives to the drug economy for a lot of the peasant farmers down there. The farmers in southern Colombia, I was down there last January, are living in incredibly poor conditions. No running water, no electricity, no sign of the state. The Colombian state has abandoned much of the countryside. It's a country that is 70% urban in population, and the Colombian elites have never wanted to lift a finger to help the people in the countryside, which is why we have an insurgency down there and why peasant farmers are turning to coca. It's the only way they can make a living down there. And so our policies of eradication basically only force these peasant farmers to make a terrible choice. We wipe out their coca crops as well as their food crops. So they have no means to survive. And so they got a couple of choices. They can either flee to the nearest city and join the already almost 2 million internally displaced people in Colombia. They're not called refugees because they haven't crossed an international border, but they're effectively refugees. And 2 million out of a country of less than 40 million is staggering. So there are no resources, very little resources to help these people. So they can either do that, or they can grow more coca, go further into the Amazon and cut down more forest and grow more coca. And we chase them with our spray planes, and we're chasing them into the heart of the Amazon. They can do that, or, you know, Colombia is facing its worst recession in 70 years. Unemployment rate is 20% higher in some places. And so there are very few sources of employment. But there are two sources of employment in southern Colombia. Primarily the armed actors, right? The right-wing paramilitary death squads or the left-wing guerrillas. And so any policy that we have that forces these peasant farmers, these peoples whose hearts and minds, if you will, we need to win over, to get them to cooperate with this policy, if we force them into the arms of our declared enemies, either the drug industry or the left or the right armed actors, any policy that does that is not only just fundamentally flawed, it's fatally flawed. We're helping our declared enemies through this policy. And it's a policy that's extremely dangerous because, you know, when most people make Vietnam analogies, I think that they're really pushing it. But in this case, I think it's a textbook case of a Vietnam-style quagmire. The U.S. is committed to a war now that we don't know how to get out of. There is no exit strategy. There's no end game. No one knows what victory will look like. No one's willing to say. You know, do we declare victory when we've wiped out 20% of the coca crop or 50% or 100%? You know, what member of Congress is going to say, well, we've wiped out 50% of the coca crop down there. Let's let them keep the other half and go home now. You know, do we declare victory and go home when U.S. citizens stop using cocaine and heroin altogether? Or do we declare victory when we've pushed the guerrillas south of the equator? Or are we trying to degrade their military capability, as was the objective in Kosovo? exactly what, you know, at what point do we declare victory and go home? And if we don't know what victory looks like, do we know what defeat looks like? Because I would argue that we've been staring at it for many years now, that after decades of you know, record amounts of counter-narcotics assistance to Colombia and the region in general, more drugs than ever are coming to the United States. This is a policy that is backfiring on us and snowballing. And part of the reason is that the drug economy is, whenever politicians try to escalate law enforcement in the face of a prohibition economy, it tends to backfire. The drug economy is something that tends to evolve under Darwinian principles, if you will. Right? The people that we manage to capture and put away tend to be the ones who are dumb enough to get caught, who are the least adaptable, the least cunning, the least sophisticated. They're clumsier. And these are the ones that we're rounding up. We're thinning out the herd. And so the people we tend to leave behind, by definition, tend to be the ones who are more adaptable, more cunning. They employ new technologies, new smuggling routes. They're innovative. We are forcing this economy to evolve much faster than it normally would. And so, you know, even the director of the CIA, if you read his testimony to Congress every year, he gives an international threat assessment. And his section on narco-trafficking this year was fascinating, because he says basically this, albeit in passive voice. You know, he says, the drug economy is being evolved faster than we can keep up with it, and it poses, you know, extreme challenges as to whether or not we can succeed with this policy. He didn't say, you know, who's causing it to evolve, but that's us. You know, another example of how escalating law enforcement tends to make things backfire. You know, the main back in the 1970s, the main illicit export from Colombia was not cocaine. It was not heroin. It was marijuana. So when Ronald Reagan comes in, he decides he wants to wage war on marijuana, and he brings in the military to South Florida and seals off, you know, the shipping routes. And the smugglers realized, hey, wait a minute, we have something else here that's a lot more compact. It's addictive to a lot of people, much higher profit margins. It's not big and bulky and smelly like marijuana. You know, and the dogs don't know how to sniff for these things yet. And we could smuggle it in suitcases, briefcases, small containers, and still make a tremendous profit. And, of course, that was cocaine. And so they developed new smuggling routes in the Gulf Coast and the Mexican border, the West Coast, East Coast, FedEx, you name it. I mean, they were very innovative and continue to be. And so, meanwhile, the dreaded marijuana we were trying to stop became homegrown. I mean, being in the Pacific Northwest, I don't need to tell you how you know, what that means. You know, and to give just one more example, and these are examples that can be applied to the domestic situation as well. You know, listeners will, you know, probably recall the dreaded Medellin cartel or the Cali cartel, the two dreaded cocaine cartels. Well, the United States helped the Colombian government take out those cartels. And what happened? Did the problem go away? Did the drug shipments decline? No, more drugs than ever are coming to the United States. So what happened? Well, Congress likes to say we're going to democratize things in Latin America. We're going to democratize Cuba. We're going to democratize Nicaragua. I would argue that the only thing that we've successfully democratized is the drug economy in Latin America. What we did was we took out the two giant monopolies that were keeping competitors out of that drug trafficking space. And so we opened up that economy to hundreds of smaller competitors, much more efficient, vertically integrated, each with their own smuggling routes, their own list of officials to bribe, very hard to infiltrate these smaller organizations, and so we made the problem worse. And you can apply the same thing to our cities at home.
Could you give us an idea on the scale of how much money we're talking about with the drug economy? Because you turn on the news any night, and economists seem to be the ones, the scientists that are really driving a lot of the news there, mm-hmm. certainly talking about, you know, Wall Street. Yet they never really brush upon, you know, let's say this drug war mm-hmm. and where the money flows through and things like that.
Yeah, according to the United Nations, they estimate that this is the international drug economy is a $400 billion a year global industry. That's about 8% of world trade. It's ahead of textiles. You know, your listeners out there are probably clothed right now. Imagine all of your clothes, you know, all of that fabric, all of that stuff. That it's ahead of that. And all this over essentially worthless, minimally processed agricultural products. Right? The alchemists of the Middle Ages tried for centuries to find a formula to turn lead into gold. They never succeeded, but it took Congress to find that formula. We have a policy that turns essentially worthless weeds into gold. So things like marijuana, for instance, Pacific Northwest marijuana, ounce for ounce, is worth its weight in gold. And you put a seed in the ground and you get gold. When you're talking about things like heroin and cocaine, they're worth many, many, many times their weight, equivalent weight in gold. So if you put that next to what we're facing in Latin America and indeed around the world, which is crushing poverty, extreme poverty, according to the UN and to the World Bank, there are 1.2 billion people in this world who live on less than $1 a day. So imagine, you know, your housing, your food, your clothing, education, taking care of your children, all on $1 a day. You know, put another way, there are 2.8 billion people in the world who live on less than $2 a day. And a lot of these people live in precisely the zones where you can grow these kinds of crops, vast stretches of the earth. And so these peasant farmers will do whatever it takes to survive. And when you combine, you know, the fact that we do not provide universal treatment on request for addicts in this country, that Congress authorized it in 1988, but never got around to appropriating the money for it, so that addicts who want to get off drugs, now I'm not even talking about the ones who are arrested by police and sentenced in drug court to mandatory treatment, I'm talking about people who actually voluntarily say, I've had enough, I really need help to get off this stuff. It's the same wherever I go around the country, the same situation. They're told by the treatment centers, look, come back 4, 5, 6 months later. Maybe we'll have a treatment slot open for you at that time. So and if you don't catch these addicts when they're ready to give up the drugs, you've probably lost that opportunity. They've gone back to using. And these are the people who are consuming the vast quantities of drugs. These are hardcore users who are consuming several times a day. And to not provide treatment on request is folly. And we're trying to waste this money in Latin America when each dollar can go 23 times farther if we spent it here on treatment. So anyway, we have a policy right now of not harm reduction, but harm maximization.
I want to get to solutions for this, but before we do, since it's so, it appears that it must be obvious to the people at the top, let's say U.S. administration, about the realities of this, about how our drug policy isn't working towards reducing the use of drugs in the U.S., how you point out that it's, in fact, kind of the Darwin theory where it's actually producing better production in Latin America. Why do we continue to go forward on this? I mean, what's motivating that?
That's a great question. You know, Congress, I work with a lot with congressional staff, and, you know, they all admit that the drug war is a dismal failure, but they're afraid. They're afraid, and their bosses are afraid to speak out on this issue. There are some that are courageous enough to do so, but for the most part, they're afraid of, in particular, the 15-second negative attack ad. You know, you've seen them on television during campaign season. They're always slimy, always false. They're sleazy, but they're incredibly effective. And that's why you have such opposition to campaign finance reform. You can do a lot of damage to your opponent in 15 seconds. They're very cheap to produce. You can run them over and over again. And so they're afraid of the ad that says, you know, Congressman Smith doesn't care if your kids are on drugs. Congressman Smith voted against Plan Colombia last year. He knows where the drugs are coming from. Send me to Washington. I will send troops down there. I will send military aid. I will clean the situation up and protect your kids. And in order for Congressman Smith to defend himself, he's got to buy a whole lot of airtime to explain a very complex issue. Or at best, he'll get, you know, 30 seconds on a 6 o'clock news to rebut this. And so all things being equal, they're afraid. They think this is not going to be a net positive for them. And so concerned citizens need to express to their members of Congress how they feel about this. And until that changes, until they tell their members of Congress, look, you know, not only is this getting tough business not going to work with me, it's going to cost you my vote. And, you know, the people are well ahead of the politicians. Whenever this stuff is put to ballot initiatives, for instance, the general public overwhelmingly supports alternatives to the drug war. The politicians are typically the last ones to get it.
So what do you see as solutions to this quagmire that we are in?
Well, I think taking the profit out of this drug industry is key. The prohibition economy right now basically generates profits for organized crime. They're the ones who control this market for the most part. You know, prohibition is what we have right now, and prohibition is an illusion. It doesn't mean that we control drugs. It means that we give up the right to control drugs. And so what I would like to do is bring these potentially dangerous substances under the domain of the law. Right now, if you ask kids what's easier to get, marijuana or alcohol, you know, overwhelmingly it's marijuana, because we give shopkeepers every incentive not to sell alcohol to underage youth. They could lose their license, they'd be prosecuted, lose their business, you know, all manner of calamity if they sell to underage kids. If you look at drug dealers, however, you know, they operate on the assumption they're not going to get caught, and by and large, most of them don't get caught. And so the dealer who sells marijuana may as well sell methamphetamine or heroin. You know, better you sell an addictive substance. You get a repeat customer. And so, you know, I would like to establish some kind of control over these substances and regulate them, right? We have a gift in this country for regulation. We regulate everything. We regulate the frequency of the radio, how much electricity can come out of a wall socket. We regulate who can sell car insurance. I can't sell you a hot dog on the street without getting a license and a health certificate. Right? And the hot dog that I buy from the factory has to come from a plant that's been inspected and certified. And the inspector has to go to an accredited university, which is itself certified. You know, all of these procedures basically to make sure that I'm not going to sell you anything in that hot dog except 100% ground up animal parts. Right? And when we look at these potentially dangerous, you know, illicit drugs, some of them much more dangerous than others, we don't regulate them at all. So we need to bring these things back under our control, under the domain of the law.
In fact, I believe it was actually a Colombian general that had said, when asked whether he wanted money to go towards interdiction down there or help up here, he had said, help up here.
Yeah, yeah. General Serrano, who's adored by Congress, he was the former head of the Colombian National Police. You know, and he was one of these people who you know, Congress has relied upon to carry out this drug war, and Mr. Clean down there. And he finally resigned. But you know, he was asked, what would you rather have, demand reduction in the United States or helicopters? He said, focus on your demand. Because until that happens, all they're doing is basically, you know, trying to plug holes in the dike. And it won't work. It's not sustainable. And so last year's $1.3 billion appropriation was the first in a series of blank checks in a war that has no end game, no logical stopping point.
I believe one of the reasons that this war continues in some ways behind the scenes, at least the media chooses not to focus on it very much, is because we're using military subcontractors, private corporations, mm-hmm. to do the dirty work down there. Could you talk about that?
Sure. We are outsourcing this drug war because there isn't popular support in this country to commit U.S. troops to another jungle war. We are using private military contractors. Some people would call them mercenaries. These are former military people, for the most part, that have gone into business for themselves, for profit. And so we are using them to carry out military training, to carry out the aerial fumigation program. We are outsourcing a lot of this. The missionary plane that was shot down over Peru was fingered by a private contractor working for the CIA. You know, these people have very little accountability you know, there's very little transparency in what they're doing. And so, you know, taxpayers are already paying $300 billion a year for the world's most powerful military, and they're being asked to pay again to a private company to duplicate the capabilities of the world's most powerful military. This does not save money, which is what the Republicans like to say, you know, privatization is for. It's about avoiding oversight, you know, keeping this below the radar screen. To hide the body bags and the flag-draped coffins. They're, you know, you don't see that anymore coming into Dover Air Force Base. Five of these private contractors have died in Colombia, and their deaths have gone largely unnoticed because they're listed as private, you know, employees who've died in the line of work. And so sooner or later, though, one of these helicopters is going to get shot down under, you know, intense media scrutiny, and Congress will have to decide, are we going to, you know, turn tail, turn the other cheek, take it on the chin, or are we going to retaliate and escalate? And this is how it starts. You send in the advisors, some get killed, you retaliate, you lose some more casualties, you escalate, and the next thing you know, you're in a real live shooting war. And so that's the danger. We don't know how to get out of this one. And people need to tell their members of Congress, you know, this is the first rule of holes. You know, when you find yourself in one, stop digging.
We only have a few minutes left. Real quickly, I wonder if you can tell us movie Traffic, a fairly popular movie, about this, or at least about part of this situation. Has that helped your cause or hurt things?
I think it's been a net positive. I mean, it stimulated debate in parts of our country and sectors that hadn't debated this before. And there are some problems with Traffic in terms of, you know, race, gender, and stereotypes and that sort of thing. But overall, it's really caused people to question the drug war. And in fact, we'll be showing clips of that, I believe, tomorrow at the Independent Media Center at 2 o'clock. There'll be a forum on Traffic and the drug war and relating that to local issues here in Seattle.
And you're speaking at a couple other events beyond that. Could you tell us those?
Yeah, I'll be speaking this morning at the Peace Cafe at 5828 Roosevelt Way, Northeast, from 10 to noon. And this afternoon at, I think, 2 o'clock at, I'm not sure exactly where that is.
The Labor Temple.
Right.
I think it's... If I remember right, I think it's 2100 3rd Avenue. Anyway, people should already be familiar with where the Labor Temple is. So, and that's at 2 o'clock for sure. So,
yeah.
All right. Only have a couple minutes left. What else would you like to convey to our listeners?
Well, basically that, you know, our policies right now of... You know, more police, more prosecutors, more prisons, more guns and helicopters to Latin America to deal with the drug problem makes about as much sense as digging more graves to solve the international AIDS problem. Right? It solves nothing. We're not looking at the root causes of why these things are happening. We're trying to repress our way out of this problem. And we need to think about this as a public health problem, one that has social and economic consequences, and rather than as a criminal justice problem. Because if you do it the way we're doing it now, the only question is, you know, what level of coercion do we need to make this problem go away? And we've never found that level, and we probably never will. So we need to focus on keeping people safe, keeping them alive, and keeping them healthy.